When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
What are you doing right now? Perhaps you're in the supermarket. Maybe you're on a run or on the commute. But wherever you are in the world, and whatever you're doing, right now you're also listening to my voice. This is the power of podcasts. The ability to communicate with your audience in an intimate and intentional way through audio. I'm Bea Duncan, Senior Partnerships Producer at Intelligence Squared. We've been a world-leading forum for talks, debates, and events for over two decades. And we also use our cutting-edge curation, creativity, and editorial expertise to elevate your brand to new audiences with podcasting. Intrigued? To find out what we can do for your organization, book into a free consultation with me today. Find out more by going to www.intelligencesquared.com/partnerships.
Welcome, everybody. It's going to be an absolutely marvellous debate tonight. This is the topic of the millennium and how perspicacious of all of you to manage to get tickets tonight to be here. We are going to have a tremendous time. We've got an outstanding panel on both sides. We have a tremendous motion. We have a wonderful audience. And you've managed to brave your way through hellish weather. Sorry, I can't say that, can I? That's compromising my neutrality. But let's get straight on. And we're going to start with Richard Harris. Richard Harris, former Bishop of Oxford. Richard.
Good evening, everybody. It's very natural for parents to be proud of their children, and three mothers were once discussing their achievements. One said, "My son's an ambassador. When he comes into the room, he's addressed as Your Excellency." To which the second mother responded, "My son's a cardinal. When he comes into the room, people call him Your Eminence." The third mother simply said, "My son is 6 foot half and a half feet tall with shoulders as wide as a barn. When he comes into the room, people get to their feet and say, 'My God.'" Obviously, nobody here believes in that kind of God. And this poses the question of what God we have in our minds when we say we believe or we do not believe. That is the question, ladies and gentlemen, at the heart of this debate. What kind of God do we accept or reject? Because there are many, many different kinds of atheism. So let me begin by emphasizing that I understand all too well and have the deepest respect for certain forms of atheism. The atheism of Camus in La Peste or Ivan Dostoevsky in The Brothers Karamazov haunts and challenges believers, perhaps even more than unbelievers. It's Attack Dogs, Daniel Dennett, Christopher Hitchens, and very sadly, from my point of view, my friend Richard Dawkins, who writes such wonderfully inspiring books on science. So it is not atheism as such which is being debated this evening, which in some forms I very deeply respect, but this new atheism that is the new fundamentalism. Now, I would suggest that fundamentalism has four main characteristics. First of all, it's impervious to the facts. Nothing is allowed to count against it. Creationism, the belief that the world was created in a very short time, as it were, ready made, is denied by every possible branch of science, cosmology, paleontology, geology, etc. It ignores the fact that the greatest philosophers in Western society down the ages for 2,000 years or more have either been religious believers or have had a philosophy which points to religious belief. They simply do not take that into account. They ignore the fact that the great inspiration behind Western art over countless centuries has been the Christian faith, and it continues to be so. The two poets universally regarded as the greatest poets of the 20th century, T.S. Eliot and W.H. Auden, were both serious Christians. Today you could count half a dozen or more of the world's greatest composers who are passionate about the Christian inspiration of their music. James Macmillan, Arvo Pärt, John Taverner, to just mention three. But all this, the new fundamentalists, simply seem to block out of their minds altogether and don't let it count against them. And this leads to the second feature of fundamentalism. It always picks on the weakest points in another person's argument. But is it not true that if you're really confident of your case, you face the opponent's strongest argument? You don't simply always focus on their weakest arguments. And then thirdly, this points to the kind of God which is so often criticized. Many of you will have read Philip Pullman's wonderful, wonderful book, The Dark Materials. But can you remember the kind of God that is pictured in that? A kind of wizened old human being, nothing better. And as a young child said once when they read that book, I never believed in that kind of God, and nor do Christian believers. And this points to the fourth and final reason why the new atheism can be described as the new fundamentalism. And that is, it focuses only on the kind of God in whom creationists believe. It looks as though religious fundamentalism and atheistic fundamentalism need each other and feed on each other. What would happen if they actually moved away from a focus upon that creationist God, upon the, what you might call the God of classical Christian theism? And these four features of fundamentalism, whether it's religious fundamentalism or atheistic fundamentalism, means that there is a great lack of what the 19th century poet Robert Browning called the grand perhaps. Ladies and gentlemen, they don't allow that grand perhaps. And surely that's one of the features of fundamentalism. They don't really allow that to count against them. The kind of God I believe in is very, very different from the kind of God which they are attacking. It's the kind of God which is revealed for me at the end of Rabbi Hugo Grin's great autobiography, where he says he was in Auschwitz as a child. He hoped God would rescue him. That God never came. And he cried and cried for hours. And then he realized that, as he says, people sometimes ask me, where was God in Auschwitz? I believe that God was there himself, he said, violated and blasphemed. The real question is, where was man in Auschwitz? So I suggest that the heart of this debate is the kind of God we do believe in or do not believe in.
Thank you very much indeed. Richard Harris there, manfully combating against an act of God with a downpour or an act of, just an act actually. But now we're going to go straight on to A.C. Grayling, a very well-known philosopher, academic author, author of Against All Gods, apart from other books. A.C. Grayling.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Well, there is a confrontation between people who have religious commitment and those who don't. And it has become a rather bad-tempered one since 9/11, since the atrocities in New York and Washington in 2001. And that date, what happened on that date, I think, changed the nature of the debate between people on either side of this confrontation. Prior to it, I think if people had a religious commitment of some kind, generally speaking, in this country at least, they kept it to themselves. Their religious proclivities were rather like their sex life. They didn't talk about it at dinner parties very much. And when one met somebody, if one wasn't oneself religious, who is religious, one wouldn't press the point very much. One would treat them rather as if there had been a death in the family, which in the case of Christianity is reasonably apt. Since 2001, however, things have changed. And they've changed in that people who don't have a religious commitment have very often spoken out robustly and uncompromisingly and have been very frank about their point of view. And it is this, I think, the tone of the discussion which has alarmed people who are defenders and apologists for religion. And it puts me in mind, rather, of a cartoon I saw recently, which has two panels. And in the first panel, there is a cleric, and he's brandishing a religious symbol of some kind, as it might be a crucifix if he's a Christian or a crescent if he's a Muslim. And he's brandishing this, and he's bashing somebody over the head with it. And as he does so, he shouts, with each blow, he shouts, "Infidel, blasphemer, homosexual, uppity woman, abortionist." And finally, the person being bashed over the head gets rather exasperated and takes the religious symbol and makes as if to break it over her knee, at which the cleric says, "Hey, hey, hey, respect." And that, I think, absolutely sums up the person who drew that cartoon would be delighted. That rather sums up the rhetorical position today. What one must understand is this, that there are charges on both sides of the debate about not understanding the other person's point of view. People of a religious commitment say this about those who don't share their views. They say, "You don't understand our position, what it's like to have a commitment, what it means to us." And that's an odd thing for them to say because, of course, the great majority of people who are not religious used to be and have become non-religious because they've given up the commitment that they were led into as children, taught at school, taught by their community, church, mosque, temple, synagogue. They've given it up sometimes with a great deal of difficulty and pain, but they understand very well what was involved and what the story is that their opponents in the discussion are committed to. But people on the religious side of the debate don't really quite see always what the point is in those who oppose them. And that's what I'd like very, very briefly to explain. Because, in fact, there are three quite separate issues here, although they naturally connect with one another. There is the question of the metaphysical nature of the universe, what kinds of things there are in the universe. People who are religious, almost all of them anyway, think that there are supernatural agencies of some kind in the universe. Gods, goddesses, angels and archangels, demons, devils. And people who don't share that view are called by religious people atheists. That's a religious term used to describe people who don't share the metaphysics of the religious. Now, I much rather call myself an atheist, or an agoblinist, or an apixiist, and so on, for all the things that I don't believe exist. But if I were to call myself an atheist or an apixiist, it would move me onto the ground of those people who believe in fairies and pixies, as if that was a discussion worth having. My point is that I don't think that there are supernatural agencies in the world on very, very good and considered grounds. The second thing, and this really is where the debate takes off, is secularism. And you don't have to be an atheist or an apixiist to be a secularist. You might be a religious secularist. Secularist is somebody who believes that questions of public policy, questions of the complex pluralistic society we live in, should not be under the government of any one religion or indeed of the religions working in committee. Secularism is about the place of religious faith in the public square. And what a reasonable secularist thinks and should think is this, that religion and religious organizations has every right to exist and every right to have its say. But it has no greater right than any other self-constituted, self-elected interest group in society. And that I think, is where a good deal of the acerbity enters the debate. I'll give you an example. As you know, President Obama is trying to get some legislation through Congress in Washington at the moment to have a national health care insurance scheme. Just very recently, in the last few days, the Roman Catholic Church, which is a very powerful lobby in the United States, has succeeded in getting a clause accepted by the House of Representatives, which provides that nobody will benefit from this national health insurance scheme in order to get a termination of pregnancy, to get an abortion. It's just one very small example. One could cite many, many examples across many societies. For example, Taliban-governed areas of Afghanistan where women and girls are not allowed education or access to healthcare and the like, where access to social goods of various kinds are denied because of questions of dogma, because a particular religious outlook doesn't favor that way of doing things or thinking about things. And when religious organizations have that impact on the lives of individuals in society, denying women their rightful place in education, denying the opportunity for people to make choices about what happens in their personal lives, where there is too much interference in the public square. And remember, in our own country, we have an established religion which allows representatives of the established church to sit in the legislature and to vote on laws that affect us all. So I mentioned atheism, mentioned secularism there, and finally there is an aspect of the debate which is more or less left out of account altogether. And that is that people who don't have a religious commitment are very often humanist in their outlook, in their ethics. And humanism is a view about the good for human individuals and the good for society, which tries to premise itself on our very best understanding of human nature and the human condition, of how things are for human beings. And it tries to erect a structure of ethical concern between individuals, urging the importance of good relationships between people, respect between human individuals on the basis of their human individuality, not on the basis of some identity that they choose for themselves, in the hope of trying to make this a collegial, cooperative, and flourishing world. That aspect of the debate is suppressed because the churches, the religious bodies, arrogate to themselves the claim that only they really have the right view about ethics, about the right way to live. So I would argue that given the fact that to be a non-believer is to stand in a relation to religion in the same way as the non-stamp collector stands to the stamp collector, that is, you just simply don't share that view, it's extremely hard indeed to be a fundamentalist non-stamp collector. You just don't take that particular view, and the fact that you don't says nothing else about what you believe and how you behave. Thank you very much.
Remind you now at this moment what in fact the motion is again. It is that the atheism is the new fundamentalism, and there is a very interesting audience vote on that initially. Well, there'll be a second vote at the end of the debate.
The events calendar is filling up here at Intelligence Squared, and to create each one, we obviously rely on some brilliant guests and onstage talent. But behind the scenes, there's also a producer, a production team, and the budget in the mix too. You've got to keep an eye on all of that stuff in one place. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. And you can cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because it's super easy to get started. NetSuite exists in the cloud, you see, no hardware needed. So you're cutting IT costs too. That's why over 37,000 companies have already made the move. And now, by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/squared. That's netsuite.com/squared. netsuite.com/squared.
And now I'm going to ask Charles Moore, former editor of the Daily Telegraph, very regular columnist now, and Charles is going to be speaking for the motion.
There is a certain absurdity, I think, in all these debates on this subject, because great minds have wrestled with them throughout history. And Milton wrote Paradise Lost, which is the greatest long poem in the English language, to justify, to assert eternal providence and justify the ways of God to men. And obviously, I, and not even the bishop, are capable of doing that very effectively tonight. But one of the strange things about our opponents, I think, is that they don't see the difficulty of this subject. To them, the truth is evident, and God and religion are evidently untrue. I think that what they think they're doing is they're shining a clear light of reason on the subject. But I would say that the light that they're casting is rather like the light, the searchlight, that the guards use in one of those war films. It sweeps wildly across the sky, and sometimes pointing vainly upwards, sometimes rushing past its intended target, and sometimes almost by chance, fixing upon the poor prisoners trying to escape to freedom. And standing behind its pitiless beam, Commandant Dawkins orders the victims to be gunned down. Our opponents tonight claim to speak for atheism. They speak with anger and with certainty. All those of us who were against fundamentalism should unite against their cause. What is it that we find so distasteful about fundamentalists? It's not that they believe something passionately. That can be a good thing. It's not even that they're stupid. Some of them are very clever. Surely what we find so unattractive about fundamentalism is the attitude that it discloses to the truth and to other people. First, to the truth. Instead of the truth being something which expands the mind, fundamentalists turn it into a harsh and narrow test to which humanity is forced to submit. Natural selection explains the whole of life, proclaims Richard Dawkins, and whatever else is said is wrong. In societies where fundamentalists gain power, such as modern Iran or Lenin's Russia, such narrow ideas of truth are imposed and brutally policed. Second, the attitude to other people. The fundamentalist attitude to those who do not accept his truth is at best pitying and at worst murderous. He thinks such people must be defective, they must be stupid or deluded. Richard's book is called The God Delusion, or evil. Professor Dawkins sees the whole debate as a whodunit, some gigantic game of Cluedo. And he thinks he knows who is guilty. It was the Reverend Green who did it, with the Bible in the nursery. And he wishes to punish him. The author writes with pride, and it's the pride of a boxer who thinks he's knocked somebody out. It's part of our opponent's fundamentalist position that they don't really distinguish between fundamentalism and other forms of religious belief. Just as followers of bin Laden will say that all infidels are damned, so these hyper-atheists say that all religion is equally contemptible. It seems to me that's like saying that fascists and liberals are really the same because both of them believe in politics. It's a grotesque parody of religious thought. In an extraordinary passage in his book, Professor Dawkins points out that members of Mensa, the society of people with a high IQ, tend to be atheists. He also says that there are few atheists in prison. Therefore, he thinks, atheists are better, brighter people than believers. Like a clever schoolboy, he thinks that only brain power matters. Well, there are plenty of examples of brain power being put to bad use. What Winston Churchill famously called the lights of perverted science have beamed with a particularly ghastly brightness in modern times. I expect that Dr. Mengele, who conducted live experiments on children for the Nazis, was a man of very high IQ. But that's not my main point. My main point here is that Professor Dawkins' attitude to the life of the mind is one of conquest. Far be it from me to disparage brain power. I thank God, literally, I thank God, for the achievements of science and for all other intellectual achievements. But is it really the case that human beings are less valuable because they are stupid or ill-educated or poor or sick or disabled? The African peasant woman who sacrifices herself to save her starving child stands higher, in some important sense, even than the president of the Royal Society, though I have no objection to that distinguished gentleman. The prisoner, whose faith Professor Dawkins looks down on with such disdain, understands something about the human predicament which is denied to those who worship only success. It's a unique feature of serious religion that it appeals both to some of the best minds who have ever lived and to the most unfortunate people in the world. It is also often very clearly grasped, and this is something which Professor Dawkins really hates, by children. Now, why? Why do the great religions, especially Christianity, put such store by the poor and the weak, the very young and the very old? I think it is because we can see what Cardinal Newman called the greatness and the littleness of man. We see the huge human capacity for achievement, invention, heroism, beauty, and love, juxtaposed sometimes in the very same human beings with cruelty, vanity, hatred, greed, and violence. And we're therefore profoundly unconvinced by explanations which are reductive and self-aggrandizing. We know that a world run by members of Mensa would not be a better place. And instead, we are attracted by paradox. We recognize truth in sentences which say that only when you are poor can you be rich, only when you are weak can you be strong, only when you die can you live. We do not abandon the power of reason, but we are aware of the ineradicable incongruity of our existence, as I say, our greatness and our littleness. So how could we be bored by what we have already discovered? We're fascinated by it. We can never stop reflecting on life's beauty and happiness, sadness and strangeness. And this means that we embrace forms of thought and communication which fundamentalists deride. So what we are saying to Professor Dawkins and Professor Grayling and all the rest of these fundamentalists tonight is what Hamlet says to Horatio: there are more things in heaven and earth than are dreamt of in your philosophy. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Well, I'd certainly make an observation at this stage, which is that the atheists are slightly better timekeepers. We're on to Richard Dawkins now. Richard Dawkins, author of God's Illusion, amongst many other books, and is himself, yes, an atheist.
Fundamentalism means different things to different people, but I think there are two elements that are common. First is blind obedience to a holy book, regardless of evidence, and this is what Richard Harris meant by impervious to facts. And the second is extremism. There is no holy book of atheism, and never could be. Atheism is not a belief system. There's no catechism of atheism, no 39 articles, no Torah, no Quran. There is no book, only publicly verifiable evidence. And that's anything but fundamentalist, because it contains a commitment to change as new evidence comes in. One of the many lies told about us is that we are dogmatically certain that we know the truth, know everything that is to be known. I think this is what Richard Harris meant by don't allow the grand perhaps. On the contrary, we glory in what we don't yet know. And that's the meaning of the quotation that Charles Moore attributed to me. It's actually Matt Ridley, my friend Matt Ridley, probably his friend Matt Ridley as well, who said that he was bored by what we already know. It's not really that we're bored by what we already know, but we're so excited by what it leads on to, which is what we don't know. We want to roll up our sleeves and get down to knowing more. And that, of course, is the real significance for a scientist of the gaps in our knowledge. To a religious person, a gap in our knowledge is likely to signify something that God did. You don't need to ask questions anymore because God simply did it. We, however, admit with some excitement that there are gaps in our knowledge, gaps waiting to be filled. Gaps do not provide a license to fill them with any old stuff that we happen to make up. And most certainly they don't provide a license for any old stuff that happened to be made up by a tribe of ignorant desert nomads and just happened to get into some holy book or other. In fact, if we're going to throw around accusations of dogmatic over-certainty, the boot is on the other foot with a vengeance. Even nice middle-of-the-road vicars and bishops are profligate with their certainties. They'll go into the pulpit and tell the congregation, God wants us to do X. God doesn't want us to do Y. How do you know? When did you ever hear a priest say, I think the balance of probability suggests that God wants X? When did you ever hear from a pulpit, we are waiting for further evidence? Let me turn now to the second meaning of fundamentalism, extremism. We are accused of being extremists. We new atheists are said to be no better than the Muslim extremists who hijack planes and fly them into buildings, or than the fundamentalist Christians who blow up abortion clinics. When was the last time you read of anybody who blew up anything in the name of atheism? Not blew something up and happened to be an atheist, blew something up in the name of atheism. Atheism doesn't have any faith schools. If we did, by the way, we wouldn't teach them atheism, we'd teach them critical thinking and how to make up their own minds. And you can be absolutely sure that we would not teach them to employ violence and certainly not suicide attacks. There is no logical pathway leading from atheism to violence. There most certainly are logical pathways leading from religion to violence. Now, of course, not many religious individuals follow those pathways to their logical conclusion, thank goodness. But there is a logical pathway from the Quran, for example, and it only takes a minority to be lured down it. For atheists, there is no such logical pathway. The nearest we get to violence is in the words we use. And there's a big difference. It's a grave misuse of the word extremism to say that atheists are just as extreme as religious extremists. As Victor Stenger, the physicist, has pithily put it in a slogan that might look well on the side of a bus, perhaps, science flies you to the moon, religion flies you into buildings. Nevertheless, atheists such as me have been accused of using the language of extremism. We are strident, shrill, intolerant, aggressive, arrogant. We worship the mind rather than the soul, rather than the heart, rather than the gut, perhaps one might say, to parody Charles Moore. And we are accused of giving offense. Well, I think a great deal of this stems simply from the fact that religion has for so long been feather-bedded. Our whole society, the non-religious as well as religious portions of it, has bought into the fiction that it's somehow bad manners to criticize religion. Douglas Adams put it beautifully in an impromptu speech in Cambridge in 1998. Religion has certain ideas at the heart of it which we call sacred or holy or whatever. What it means is, here is an idea or a notion that you're not allowed to say anything bad about. You're just not. Why not? Because you're not. We're used to not challenging religious ideas. But it's very interesting how much of a furore Richard creates when he does it. Everybody gets absolutely frantic about it because you're not allowed to say these things. So when somebody like me says something even mildly critical of religion, it is heard as strident and aggressive, even if it's actually less so than would be perfectly acceptable if it were anything other than religion that was being criticized. There's nothing really new about the so-called new atheists. Nothing new in what we say. The only thing new about us is that we speak up and we call a spade a spade. This is not fundamentalism. It's just honest clarity of expression. We use our brains rather than our gut. New atheism speaks clearly. This used not to happen. Atheists were supposed to know their place, to shut up and respect automatically religious faith. I love a quotation from Johann Hari, who said, "I respect you too much to respect your ridiculous ideas." So entrenched is the assumption, implicitly accepted for centuries by religious and non-religious alike, that religion must automatically be respected, that even clarity is heard as offensive. As fundamentalist, indeed, I'm confident that this audience will not be swayed by such pussyfootery and will vote with their heads instead of with their guts. Vote against this motion. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you very much indeed, Richard, and you'll be very glad to know that you're in the school which is teaching critical thinking, philosophy, and indeed thinking to every single student. You'll be less pleased to hear that we're also teaching Christianity and Buddhism and Hinduism, but, you know, we try and cover all different types here. How have you voted? Well, don't knows. There's some 200 of you who haven't voted at all so far. But amongst the don't knows, 389, those voting for the motion, which to remind you is that atheism is the new fundamentalism, 333, and against, this is before the debate voting as you were coming in, against the motion, 675. The question is, how is that going to transfer during the course of the evening, now you've heard the debate? And let's move straight on to the questions, please.
Hello. I am interested that there can be fundamentalists on both sides, it seems to me. It's very easy to pick out people who are fundamentalists. The argument that Richard Dawkins was putting, which was that you cannot have a fundamentalist on the atheist side, is it not a fundamentalist position to say there is no God?
And then a quick response from, first of all, Charles Moore.
Did you notice that atheist bus campaign that they had? On the side, it said, there's probably no God. And the reason they said that, I think, is they realised they were in a bit of a muddle about this, because they could only truthfully say, according to their own position, that there's probably no God, because if they said there is no God, they would be making a statement of faith, and of course they feel they mustn't do that. So they're actually in a bit of a muddle about what on earth they were talking about.
Richard's not in a muddle.
What could be more fundamentalist than saying there is definitely no God? We demonstrated our lack of fundamentalism by saying the proper scientific thing, there's probably no God.
Thank you. I'm going to bring in Anthony one second. So, Richard, does that mean there may be a God, logically?
There may be a leprechaun.
If I might say something, yes. No, you can't let Richard get away with that. That's a ridiculous remark. No. That is a ridiculous remark.
Okay,
you cannot confuse the God of classical theism, which has animated the whole of Western philosophy, with a leprechaun, and I'm surprised at you.
Anthony says you can.
Look, firstly, with great respect to Charles Moore, it's he who's rather confused about the atheist bus. We did want to say there is no God on the bus. And it turned out that the Advertising Standards Authority required of us that we insert a probably there, despite the fact that the very many theist adverts on buses say things like Jesus saves and so on, rather unequivocally.
Okay, thank you for that. Question one over here, please. Darren, yes?
Hello. How can you advocate the fact that my child could have an entirely different education to their neighbour just because they've gone to a faith school? And how can you ethically advocate that I will be governed by laws that I don't believe in because I'm a secular humanist?
Thank you for that. The person with the microphone. Yep.
I have a question for Charles Moore and Richard Harries. Do you think that if your subtle, scholarly, nuanced brand of religion was the norm, Richard Dawkins and A.C. Grayling wouldn't have had to write their books? The point is, I attended a lecture at a top British university last year given by the head of Answers in Genesis, Ken Ham, who was not only preaching scientific ignorance, he was also preaching right-wing bigotry from the grave of Jerry Falwell. Why shouldn't we get angry about that?
I'm going to ask the side to come in first on those.
I don't believe that I was arguing for a subtle and nuanced brand of Christianity. I think I was simply arguing for a mainstream traditional form of Christianity. And, of course, you're right to attack people like the person you mentioned. But I don't think we should allow ourselves to be marginalised by thinking we're a sort of clever, super-modern version of Christianity that's being put forward, at least by me. This is just what has been put forward by mainstream churches throughout history. And one of the things that I think is quite wrong about the Dawkins-Grayling argument is to characterise... It's the other way round from what you're saying. They're taking people like mad creationists, and they're trying to project that onto the whole of the Christian faith for 2,000 years. That seems to me a total misrepresentation.
Richard?
I think we need to emphasise, of course, there's a very great deal of bad religion around, and bigotry, wherever it appears, needs to be attacked. But the debate tonight is not about bad religion. It's a question of whether the new atheism has slipped into a kind of fundamentalism. That is what the debate is about. Atheism, faced with certain forms of religion, is a kind of purification, is a necessary purification. And I made it clear at the beginning there are many forms of atheism I deeply respect.
Yes. On this question, which the questioner raised about the good and the bad kinds of religion, I think he's absolutely right. It would be marvellous if all religious people were like our two panellists here tonight. And it may be right that deserves the title mainstream in some historical periods, but I rather doubt that. But the fact is, it doesn't today. And if you go to the United States, as I often do, the huge majority of religious people are just the kind of religious people you don't want. And that's the reason why I found it necessary to write The God Delusion. The question is absolutely right. There would have been no need if everybody was like Charles Moore and Richard Harries, but unfortunately, they're not. To pick up on the Cluedo jibe that Charles Moore raised, that the Reverend Green did it. In America, he's not even called the Reverend Green. He's called Mr. Green. He's not allowed to be called the Reverend Green because in America it's inconceivable that a clergyman could possibly do anything wrong.
Anthony.
I mean, just to revert to the rhetorical point about the name-calling which is going on, fundamentalist atheists and so on, the truth of the matter is that people who are troubled by the criticisms levelled at them really do set the bar very, very low indeed as to what they will accept in the way of criticism. So if they're spoken to rather robustly, you know, people who criticise religion are said to be intolerant of religion, as though a physicist who doesn't believe in magic is intolerant of magic. It's an attempt to try to displace the criticism by attacking the criticizer. I mean, one thing that was very noticeable about Charles Moore's contribution this evening was that it was very largely an ad hominem attack on Richard Dawkins, not really an attack on the idea.
Anthony, we're going to have a question. There's a lot of questioners over here. I'm very keen to get some questions down over on this side here, but a gentleman here first. Good, and then over here, please.
Professor Dawkins, you are arguably the world's leading apologist for atheism, and you have been invited on several occasions by arguably the world's leading Christian academic apologist, Dr. William Lane Craig, to engage in debate. I would like to know why this is not an example of the new atheist doing what Lord Harries has described as avoiding the strongest possible arguments from the opposition.
Okay, thank you. That's a very straight question. Over here now, and then at the back, please. Let's take question number two at the back, please. Yep.
Atheist fundamentalism is not a new phenomenon. If Professor Dawkins had read history of Russia and China, he would know that atheism conducted programs of violence against people of faith. Have you a comment to make on that, please?
Okay, we'll take Richard first on why you're not apparently prepared to debate against that lady. Then we'll come over here and we'll finish up on the question there about Stalin's gulags.
I have always said when invited to do debates that I will be happy to debate a bishop, a cardinal, a pope, an archbishop. Indeed, I have done both. But that I don't take on creationists and I don't take on people whose only claim to fame is that they are professional debaters. They've got to have something more than that. I'm busy.
And if she said she was busy too, you would say...
It was a he, actually, but...
Oh, my goodness. What a boob. Over here, moving straight on. Yeah, now the response on Russia, Richard.
The implication was made that the monstrosity, the awfulness of Stalin's Russia, Mao's China, had something to do with atheism. These were dreadful people having dreadful political philosophy, which they ruthlessly enforced in their countries. It is incidentally true that they happened to be atheists. It's incidentally true that Hitler, Stalin, and Saddam Hussein all had moustaches. But it's nothing to do with either their moustaches or, in the case of Stalin, his atheism. Hitler wasn't an atheist.
Okay. Yep. Lady, yes. Excellent. Lady first.
How would you respond to a sign that I saw outside a what appeared to be sort of a mainstream church in the UK, in the southeast, saying, don't think, just believe?
Don't think, just believe. And one over here, yes. Second questioner. And let's take the third question. Go, yeah, gentleman here.
Could I ask each side to give an account of the criteria they use for assessing truth?
Okay.
And then to justify that against the charge of fundamentalism.
All right. And while we're doing this, and the third question is doing it, can we please make certain that you cast your votes? The votes... Please. Everyone clear about the votes? Hope so. Questioner here. Yes, please.
Richard Dawkins, as has already been said, you're quite happy with the atheist bus campaign wording. Yeah, after all, you endorsed it. It said, God probably doesn't exist. Now, I'm a bit sad. I brought a dictionary along with me, which suggests that someone of that point of view is an agnostic. Doesn't that mean that... It's actually an agnostic bus campaign. You're actually agnostic, and you're probably not the best qualified person to oppose the motion tonight.
Excellent, excellent. Wonder what school you went to. Yes, let's begin, I think, on this side, in fairness.
Criteria for truth, very briefly, the total human experience, not just what we might derive from science, but our experience of beauty, our experience of conscious, our experience of human relationships, all this we put together and wonder what the heck it's all about. So it's the total range of human experience.
Charles Moore, what are you going to pick up on?
I just wanted to say that I'm interested by the way these questions have gone, because it illustrates the problem we have with the whole of this debate, which is it's always the serious question that's impossible to answer. And indeed, when the serious question is raised, the chairman says, oh, that's very difficult, and let's go on to another one. And the trouble, and this is why I worry about the new the fundamentalist atheist, is because what it is using the method of scorn in order not to have the argument. It's always saying, you know, here's the ridiculous example, here's the reductio ad absurdum, here is the bad behaviour, instead of trying to actually to address and talk about these questions that keep coming from so many people in the hall tonight and so many people all over the world who actually want to think about the answers.
Okay. Thank you very much. I don't, in fact, Charles, I didn't quite accept that, because I think you have had every chance to come back and answer at length. You haven't always chosen to do so. Are there any other of the questions that were asked in that batch that you'd like to come back on?
I'm not complaining personally. I haven't been persecuted. I fear that the whole discussion about these issues is constantly misrepresented by the form that it takes and by the type of argument that sometimes comes from the atheist fundamentalist.
Okay.
Earlier on, Richard made a wonderfully telling point, I thought, when he said he'd never heard from a pulpit the remark on the balance of probabilities. Well, I can honestly say, I think I've read nearly all your books, I've never read the statement on the balance of probabilities there might not be a God.
What about the bus campaign?
I'll eat my words if you can point that.
Well, but I can.
They're so definite.
No. Chapter 4 of The God Delusion is called Why There Almost Certainly Is No God. I have put forward a 7-point scale from 1 total certainty there is a God to 7 total certainty there is no God, and I place myself as a number 6.5.
Chapter 4, verse 2, do you want to come back on that?
Well, that's not quite the same as the balance of probability. You know, it's almost certainly probable. It's not quite the same, the balance of probability.
Well, if by that you mean we should be saying 50%, I'm certainly not happy to go for 50%.
I think I've... You asked a very interesting earlier question about experience of atheism. I draw a distinction between intellectual atheism and experiential atheism. The kind of experience the poet Edwin Muir had once in a bus, when the human beings in front of him were suddenly stripped of any sense of being human. Now, I do think that is a totally devastating experience. You sometimes get it after a Samuel Beckett play. A wonderful playwright, but you suddenly feel human beings have been stripped of anything to do with the spirit. Now, actually, I think many religious believers go through that kind of experience of atheism, where the world suddenly seems totally devoid and empty of God. And it might have been that experience of Jesus on the cross, you know, when he said, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? I think that sense of experiential atheism is actually much more disturbing than intellectual atheism.
Now I'd like to answer the questions, if I may. Don't think, just believe. Yes, that's one of the explanations for the persistence of religion. It reminds me of my favourite joke from Bertrand Russell, who said, most people would rather die than think, and most people do. That explains that one. I've got a challenge to explain my criteria for truth. Truth is a very, very hard thing to find, except in local empirical circumstances. Much, much more significant than that is rationality. Rationality is the key. To behave, to think, and to believe rationally on the basis of the evidence, that is the surest path towards truth. You have to remember what Voltaire said. I will defend with my life the person who is seeking the truth, but I will not be so keen on the person who claims to have it. Finally, there is one big difference between Richard Dawkins and myself on the question of the 6.5 and agnosticism. I am not one little bit agnostic about fairies or pixies or goblins and so on, for all the other supernatural agencies that might be invoked. Don't forget, by the way, that fairies were very, very widely believed in this country until pretty recently. Now, I'm not an agnostic about that, and for exactly the same kind of rational, I hope, reasons, I'm not agnostic about deities and gods and goddesses and the rest of it.
Thank you for that. Now we're going to now have the sum-ups, and there's a premium here on doing it in 2 minutes each. I'm going to ask Richard Dawkins to begin by summing up everything you've heard and everything you want to say.
I suppose the two main issues that have come up are, first, the idea that we on this side are somehow bleak and empty, and the distinction that Richard Harris made about experiential atheism, the sense of despair which is supposed to afflict us when we lose faith. As Anthony Grayling has just said, it's nothing like that at all. On the contrary, it's a sense of release. It's a sense of freedom from an oppressive overlookedness. You somehow realize that you are free, you're in control of your own life, you are
looking out at the universe, I know that I'm going to die and it's finite, all the more reason to appreciate it, to enjoy it, and to exult in it. Now, the other issue is the narrow one of the motion, are we fundamentalist? I think it's probably fair to say that some of us are passionate and that we are deeply passionate. We care deeply about, for example, the truth, which I would define as that which is supported by objectively discernible evidence. But please don't mistake passion for bigotry, for narrowness, for arrogance, for fundamentalism. You can be passionate without being fundamentalist. There really is an important difference. I'm happy, indeed proud, to be passionate. I'm happy to be passionate about the truth. I'm happy, I hope, to speak clearly, but none of that implies fundamentalism in the sense of extremism or in the sense of implacable devotion to some kind of holy book.
I was very glad to hear what Richard Dawkins said just then, but I don't think that is the characteristic of his writing and preaching. And this is what we complain about with atheist fundamentalism, because though it's admitted that there may be a God, it's then immediately spoken all the time as if there couldn't possibly be one, and also no attempt is made to understand what religion is as it's understood by its adherents. Richard spoke eloquently of that sense of freedom. I do assure you that Christians believe that freedom. They experience that freedom. And I do assure you also that when they lie down and look at the Milky Way, they have comparable experiences. But I think that they have an experience which goes a bit deeper and goes a bit further about what they see. And that experience is summed up in the last line of perhaps the greatest poem ever written, Dante's Divine Comedy, when he speaks of the love which moves the sun and the other stars. And that is the case which we feel is consistently misrepresented, and the case which, if the atheist fundamentalists had the intellectual honesty which they say they did, they would listen to that with more respect rather than traducing it.
Thank you.
A.C. Grayling summing up against the motion.
Well, Charles Moore reminds us, and I mentioned this in my opening comments, that a standard charge laid against people who don't have a religious outlook is that they don't understand the religious outlook, that we don't appreciate how it feels to be religious and to have that way of looking at things. And I pointed out that the great majority of people who don't have a religious outlook used to have one. Most atheists are people who have won through to an open-minded, free-thinking way of looking at the world from having been brought up in one or another religion, their parents' religion usually, and had it inculcated into them when they were very young. So we do understand it, and it may very well be that we understand it all too well. It's not that we don't understand it, we understand it all too well, which is why we disagree with it. That's point number one. And point number two, Charles and others say what we should try to make some sense of the inner meaning, the inner workings of a religious outlook. The problem is this, that religion, for somebody who is critical of its premises, is in the same sort of position as astrology. Now, astrology bases itself on the idea that what we can see from planet Earth in the way of heavenly bodies has an influence on our character and our destiny. Once you've come to the conclusion that that just ain't so, then there's no point in getting involved in all the complexities of the different astrological theories. Once you've come to the view that this is just an untenable position, no point in going into all the things that Charles Moore says we should get into in trying to understand that the internal feeling of that position. Fact is that rejecting a certain view, rejecting a certain way of looking at the world, entails nothing further other than a responsibility to begin to think carefully about what you do think and why, how you would make a good, responsible case for that, and how you would live responsibly and well in a world where it is our job as human beings to make the best fist we can
of our endowment in nature.
A.C. Grayling, thank you very much indeed. And
I'd just take the opportunity, if I may, to address the last question, which was all asked from the audience, about whether Charles and myself are not really on the defensive on this issue now. And strangely, I think I would want to admit that, in a sense, we are, because on the one hand, we're battling against creationist religious fundamentalists, and on the other hand, against the new atheists. And I've suggested at the beginning the sense in which they feed each other, and it's therefore very, very difficult to get across the case for classical Christian thought in the Western tradition. And if I might say so, I think Anthony slipped into that again earlier on, where he put together not believing in fairies and not believing in what he called deities. But in that sense, the early Christians, as I said earlier, were atheists. They didn't believe in deities. They believed in the God of classical Western theism, who is not an existent in the world of existence, not a thing in the world of things, but the ground and goal of all existence, in whom all things exist. John of Damascus, in the 8th century, and no doubt I might be scorned for quoting somebody such a long time ago, but John of Damascus in the 8th century, great bastion of Christian Orthodox in the East, said, "What God is in himself is totally incomprehensible and unknowable." And it's that sense of the mystery of God. We can use words about God and deity and deities, but in the end, we're talking about something which is beyond human words. And I think it's that sense of mystery which both religious fundamentalism and the new atheism somehow fail to point to in any way.
Thank you. And now, before I wish you all a very safe onward journey, and thank you very much indeed. Thank you very much indeed for supporting tonight. The online vote was 12 agnostics, 35 for it, and 877 against the motion, which could mean that atheists go online. The don't knows amongst the cognoscenti, those with the presence of mind, the consciousness, the belief to be here tonight. 389 didn't know before the motion, and now only 85 don't know the truth. For 333 before and 675 against, after everything they've heard, those four voting for the motion have gone up. They've gone up from 333 to 363. Those against from 675 up to 1,070. So 675 to 1,070, and therefore I declare that the vote has been carried against.
What are you doing right now? Perhaps you're in the supermarket. Maybe you're on a run or on the commute. But wherever you are in the world, and whatever you're doing, right now you're also listening to my voice. This is the power of podcasts. The ability to communicate with your audience in an intimate and intentional way through audio. I'm Bea Duncan, Senior Partnerships Producer at Intelligence Squared. We've been a world-leading forum for talks, debates, and events for over two decades. And we also use our cutting-edge curation, creativity, and editorial expertise to elevate your brand to new audiences with podcasting. Intrigued? To find out what we can do for your organization, book into a free consultation with me today. Find out more by going to www.intelligencesquared.com/partnerships.